Rhoda is a lecturer in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Sheffield, where her research uses approaches from theoretical physics to study biological and biologically inspired systems. And this involves collaboration with other scientists from a range of disciplines, including biology and medicine. Rhoda obtained her first degree, an M.Physics, or M. I don't know if you say M.Phys anyway, but anyway, that's where it was, Master of Physics, from the University of Oxford, and a PhD from the University of Durham, where she was supervised by Tom McLeish, known to many of us. She then held a variety of postdoctoral positions in the Netherlands, France, and the UK. She's a visiting lecturer at the African Institute for Mathematics, and has lectured in South Africa, Senegal, and Ghana. And I gather she's just off on Sunday night to South Africa and Malawi on a research program, so she travels, she's international. And in addition to her international academic track record, Rhoda is a very active member of CIS, both nationally and in Sheffield, and regularly speaks on science and faith. So she's very much a worthy recipient of the first Oliver Barkin lecture, and we look forward to the lecture she's now going to give us, which is called, I think, simply Order and Disorder. So, Rhoda.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank those people who nominated and chose me for this prize lecture. It's a real honour to be chosen, and I hope that what I will present to you as a talk will be an inspiration to those people who are younger than myself, and please keep your eyes open for them and nominate them for next year's award. So what I'm going to talk about is order and disorder. On this slide, you see one picture that you will see is ordered and one that is disordered. I hope it's obvious which is which. That's just a simple example of rod-like particles that are either ordered or disordered. So I think it's clear to you what I mean by order and disorder, but just to be sure, I'm going to give you an introduction to order and disorder first, and then I'm going to talk about examples of order and disorder in science, particularly related to some of the science research that I do. And then I'm going to, at the end, make some connections with Christian theology. Now, this talk is going to be a broad brush overview. I'm going to cover many different areas, and I hope you will bear with me, not going into too much detail in any of them. But what I want to do is set out various ideas, and I hope you'll see that there's an overarching theme to these ideas. And at the start of the talk, I'd like to say that I'm actively looking for people to collaborate with, discuss with, have conversations with on any of these ideas. So please come and chat to me in the discussion at the end, but also in the coffee break, and let me know if you're interested in taking some of these thoughts forwards. So that we're clear on what I mean by disorder, I think it's important... Oh, I've realised I've not been changing the slides. Sorry. Okay. There we go. Right, I've got two computers here to change, so I'm getting used to it. Okay, so disorder, random, chance, these are words we use quite a lot, but they can be confusing because there are different meanings of the word random. So just so we're all on the same page to start with, I am not going to be talking about the everyday life meaning of random as purposeless by chance. I'm going to be talking more about the scientific meaning of random, and what I mean by that is microscopic details are unpredictable, either in theory or in practice, and I'll give you examples of both, but macroscopic processes may be predictable. So you see on the slide there a picture which, to those at the back, probably just looks grey. To those at the front, you might notice that it's not actually grey. There are black dots on white background, and the black dots are positioned randomly. That's an example of disorder, what we might call white noise in this case. So I'm going to talk about different places in science where order and disorder interplay. So first of all, let's go back to classic physics, thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics, for those people who are not physicists or chemists and not comfortable with this concept, and the second law of thermodynamics states that entropy always increases. Entropy is a measure of disorder. So what that means is that in general, things go from order to disorder, overall, in what physicists call a closed system. But what that means is that for a local system, the opposite might be true. We can go from order to disorder, as long as overall, the whole system, disorder always increases. So that's one of the laws of nature. We've heard lots about laws of nature earlier this morning. So I'd like to show you an easy, simple example of where thermodynamics is important, and that's in phase transitions. So phase transitions, the one we're most comfortable and with, which we experience in our daily lives, is water going from a solid ice to liquid water that we drink to a gas, steam, when we make a cup of tea. And we can go from one state to another by increasing the temperature. The solid ice is the ordered, most ordered state, and the disorder increases as we go to the liquid and the gas. That's an easy example. An example that some of you may be less familiar with is what I call liquid crystal phases. Now, liquid crystals are very common in your daily lives. I'm convinced that all of you actually own liquid crystals, because these days we all have gadgets with liquid crystal displays in them. So your mobile phone, your laptop, etc., has liquid crystals. So actually we're using a lot in technology these days. Now these are made up of particles that are not point-like, they're not little spheres, the particles are like little rods. And if you have particles that are little rods, then there's more things that can happen to them than just solid, liquid, and gas that I described with water. So on the slide here, you see different examples. So first of all, the crystalline solid is the most ordered case, where you see that both the position and the orientation of the rods are all in the same direction and all ordered. But then you can have, if I go all the way to the other side of the slide, then we have what we call an isotropic liquid crystal. The positions of the particles are random, but also the directions, the orientations, are all in different directions, all at random. But there's an in-between state, which we call a pneumatic liquid crystal, where here, if you look carefully at my cartoon, all the directions are pointing in the same way, all the orientations are the same, but the positions of the particles are at random. So this is a nice in-between state of partial order and partial disorder. And another thing I want to point out about these kind of systems is that so we can change from one to the other by changing our experimental conditions, but the system can choose which direction randomly, spontaneously. We call this spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so I've drawn on the slide the orientation to be up-down, but the system could choose any other angle as the orientation, and that can be chosen at random spontaneously. So that's an interesting feature of these disorder-to-order transitions, that some elements of them are spontaneously chosen by the system. I'd like to now show you an example of an experimental system which shows what I would call disorder emerging into order. So order emerges out of disorder. So on the screen you see a green blob. This is the state where I would say it's disordered. And Sam at the back is going to help me show the video, because we had some technical problems before. And what you will see when it runs, if it runs, is what you'll see is this green blob overall is now changing. And what you're going to see emerging is some striped patterns. So look for the striped pattern emerging. So you see here the striped pattern is emerging. Now, what is this? These are filaments of proteins inside a plant cell. They're called microtubules, for any biologists who want to know what they're called. These are microtubules, and there's a beautiful ordered pattern emerging from the disorder there. This happens in plant cells, and it happens after division, every time the cell divides. And there's a particular direction chosen by these striped patterns, and that direction is important for the plant because that direction dictates the direction the plant is going to grow in. Now, I work quite a lot on cell movement, and as animals, we move around, but plants don't move around in the same way. So if they want to move, they have to grow in a particular direction, and this is what happens in order to
make that work. So this is an example of emergent order out of what looks like a disordered system. So what I mean by disorder there is that the microtubules are initially in all random directions, and they come together all to point in the same direction. So moving on, how do physicists describe systems like this? So I started off with thermodynamics, but I'd now like to talk about statistical mechanics. My research involves a lot of statistical mechanics, and it's probably my favourite area of physics, but it's maybe not as popular an area as things like quantum mechanics and astrophysics, which I will make some comments on later. But because it's not so popular, you might be less familiar with it if you're not a physicist. So what do I mean by statistical mechanics? So statistical mechanics is all about calculating what we can calculate for systems that have disorder on a small length scale, and we calculate emergent ordered properties on a larger length scale. So a good example is the gas particles in this room. There's lots of them, and they're disordered in the sense that we don't know exactly where the particles are. We don't know exactly how fast they're moving, just because it's very difficult to know. This is different from quantum mechanics in the sense that they are determined, but it's just in practice very difficult to measure them. But we know very precisely the temperature of this room. We can measure that. We've been measuring that for a long time. So statistical mechanics is all about going from all those lots and lots of gas particles to how do we calculate large-scale properties we call macroscopic properties from those microscopic properties of the random particles. So I'm hoping the slide will appear if possible. So there's a bit of a joke about physicists not being able to count. I assume some of you will have heard of it, but not all of you. So physicists count in the following way. 1, 2, infinity. And that's because that reflects what we can actually do. Physicists are quite simple-minded in some senses, and we can calculate things when there's one object, and we can calculate things when there's two objects, and we can calculate things very well when there's an infinite number of objects, and that's what statistical mechanics is about. If you want to calculate when there's a few objects, say five, it's very, very difficult, and that's where computers are used to help us out. But if you want to do accurate calculations, actually physicists are only good at doing 1, 2, or infinity. So statistical mechanics is correct when you have an infinite number of particles that you're talking about. Obviously, we never actually have an infinite number of particles, but in practice, the number of gas particles in this room is near enough infinity, and therefore statistical mechanics works very well in a system like that. The systems I work on in my research are in biological cells, and that becomes quite interesting. Like the example I showed you before of the microtubules, whether the techniques of statistical mechanics work well for a system like that or not is interesting and under question, because sometimes we don't have enough copies of the particles to be sure that our infinity assumption is correct. So sometimes we get interesting discussions as to what techniques we can use there. But statistical mechanics works very well when you've got lots and lots of examples, because if you imagine taking an average, you know that the more examples you've got, the better your average is, and the smaller your standard deviation is, and that is why statistical mechanics works best when you have lots and lots of particles. This video won't work because, maybe it does. No, it doesn't. We don't have any slides. Can we have the slides back? This is going to be really a shame to do this without slides. Can we just take a pause and see if we can get the slides back? Okay, so what I was talking about here was I was talking about statistical mechanics, and I'm now going to talk about an example of that, which is Brownian motion. This is not actually correct Brownian motion. This is just a PowerPoint fudge. I was honest there. So these are particles that are moving around randomly. And they're moving around because they have thermal energy. And the Brownian motion was actually first observed by Robert Brown on pollen grain particles. And the pollen particles he was looking at are much bigger than the water that they were in. And so what's actually happening here is it's the water molecules that are moving around with thermal motion, thermal energy, and they bump into the larger particles of pollen. But this, because the pollen particles are much bigger than the water particles, it's actually quite an interesting story, because they only move when lots of water molecules bump into the pollen grain at the same time in the same direction. So this is actually an example of rare, what we call rare events. And it was actually Einstein who worked out how this works. And it was his PhD thesis, by the way. This is random motion. This is an example of random motion. And I'm going to now talk about a more biological, well, they're both are biological because Robert Barron was a botanist. But I'm now going to talk about another example of something that's random. And I'm going to use the phrase stochastic processes. Stochastic is a scientific word basically meaning random. What we mean by a stochastic process is that we don't know exactly when events will occur in a stochastic process. Overall, if we wait long enough, we can predict very well average properties. So, for example, the picture you have there on the slide is a cartoon of a filament like the microtubules I was talking about before. Now, these actually, what we call polymerize, they grow longer and they grow shorter. But we don't know exactly when a new subunit will add on. That is a stochastic process. That is a random process. And we cannot predict the exact time that that will happen. But we can predict very accurately the probabilities of when it will happen, so that if we look at it on a slightly longer timescale, we can actually start talking about speeds of elongation and average speeds of elongation, even though we don't know the exact moment when a new protein will bind on to the end of the filament. And so we talk about rate constants on off of binding on of the proteins onto the end of the filament. So this is an example of stochastic processes. Nature is full of examples of stochastic processes, and biology in particular has got many, many stochastic processes happening, because most biochemical events are all at the basis of them stochastic processes, in terms of exactly when molecules will touch each other and interact and react. I can't resist a few comments on chaos in a talk like this. You've probably all heard of the butterfly effect. It was actually mentioned earlier this morning. And that's just the idea. It's a helpful analogy, although some people think it's not so helpful. But it is an analogy saying that if a butterfly flaps its wings over Africa, that will affect the weather in London in 3 weeks' time. It's a way of trying to express why it's so difficult to predict medium-term weather. When I say medium, I mean sort of on the scale of weeks. We can predict long-term climate trends, and we can predict what the weather will be like in an hour's time. But anything in between is very difficult. And that's because it's due to... So chaos is actually due... there's a subtlety here, so I want to explain it clearly. The equations are what we call deterministic. So this is not like quantum mechanics. The equations are deterministic. We can calculate results. But the problem is that any small fluctuations are amplified such that they have a dramatic effect on the outcomes. So a good example of this is a pendulum. Normal pendulum, we can calculate very nicely. But if you start the pendulum off with a very large angle, and it will start being unpredictable in its motion. And so the small angle pendulums are very easy, but large angle pendulums become difficult. And so the reason for this is not because it's indeterminate, but because small fluctuations make a big difference. And so this is the effect of chaos. It's particularly seen in nonlinear differential equations, or nonlinear equations that are deterministic. And these days, we can study these effects very nicely in computer simulations. One good example... Oh, sorry, I've not changed the slide, sorry. Okay. One good example of this is turbulence. So you see turbulence when you feel turbulence when you're in an aeroplane, and you see turbulence in turbulent waters. So this is a picture here of some white water, and the directions of the velocities of all the different water particles are just all over the place. They're chaotic, and that's an example of turbulence. I've recently worked on a very interesting subtle twist on this that we call active turbulence. Now this is still slightly controversial as to the words you're allowed to use for this, because this is a system in which turbulence should not normally happen. You do not get turbulence. You get turbulence in water, but you do not get turbulence in honey. That's because honey is very viscous, very sticky, and so everything happens very slowly in honey. That is, assuming that you are, in the technical language, in equilibrium. The systems I work on have energy input into the constituent particles. Now, in the systems I work on, that's biochemical energy that's being input into this constituent particles. And this energy, biochemical energy or otherwise, drives the system out of equilibrium and allows it to do things it wouldn't normally do. So this can allow you to get something that looks very turbulent, looks like chaos, but in systems that are ought not to show that because they're too viscous, they're too sticky. So the pictures you see at the bottom of the slide there are, if you can see them behind the screen there, they're actually results of computer simulation done by my former PhD student Carl Whitfield on this kind of turbulence, and this shows the transition towards a turbulent-like system. I've mentioned quantum mechanics a couple of times, so I think I ought to mention it properly now. Quantum mechanics is a little bit different in the sense that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics says that we cannot know the outcome of a quantum mechanical process. So in chaotic systems, we don't know because we can't measure accurately enough the small changes, and the small changes get amplified. Whereas for quantum mechanics, we cannot know until we have measured the event. So we cannot know, for example, in the picture you see there, I have an electron source and I have a double slit. And we cannot know which of the two slits the electron will go through until after the event. And so this is slightly different sort of unknowing, if you like. It's indeterminate in the sense that we don't know it in theory as well as in practice. So quantum mechanical effects are seen for very small things, and but when you average over lots of those events, then we see things that we can predict very accurately, which is why we don't see in our everyday lives some of the weird quantum mechanical effects that you can see in experiments. So I've talked lots about probability and the importance of probability in the way that we calculate things, that sometimes we cannot calculate exactly, but we can calculate probabilities. And if we average over a large enough number of events or number of particles, then we know quite well. I said this was going to be a broad brush, so I thought I'd mention astrophysics as well. All the systems I've talked about so far have talked about disorder on a very small length scale and order on a larger length scale. So you get order emerging from disorder where the order is on the larger length scale. And when I was thinking about this, I thought astrophysics may provide some opposite examples, whereby when we look at a very large scale, then things may look disordered. There's stars in random places just all over the place, and it just looks disordered. But when we look on smaller astronomical length scales, then we see order appearing in that disorder, in the sense that we see clusters of stars, and we see galaxies so we see the ordered patterns of galaxies in what, when we look at a larger length scale, might have looked like disorder. So this could be an example of order appearing out of disorder, but the order is appearing on a smaller length scale. So this could be emergence of order at a smaller length scale. I've talked quite a bit about biology and physics, because those are my areas of research, the interface between those two subjects. And I'd like to make some comments about disorder in life. So in order for living things to exist, life needs to maintain order. And in order for that to happen without the second law of thermodynamics breaking, in other words, the second law of, law of thermodynamics said that the systems must always go to more disorder, so the disorder increases. But in life, to maintain order, we need an input of energy and waste heat. And so that way, locally, living systems can have a lot of order. And an example of this is the mutation rate in DNA. So the mutation rate is only 1 in 100 million per generation. That's pretty accurate. Oh, sorry, I keep forgetting to change the slides. Thank you. The photograph that you see here is me, and I'm running, and the banana is necessary for me to run. And that is an example of the fact that if we did not continually take in food in order to keep our systems out of equilibrium and have the energy, then we would die. And in terms of order and disorder, that means that we would descend into disorder. So I've implied that disorder is negative there, making a correlation between death and disorder. But there's lots of examples of a positive role for disorder in biology. One example is what I spent my PhD years on, when, along with Tom McLeish, I was studying protein vibrations, so internal vibrations of proteins, and calculating the entropy associated with those vibrations. And what we found there was, in certain interactions between proteins and DNA, roughly half of the energy of interaction actually comes from changes to this vibrational entropy. And so the disorder aspect is playing a very positive role here. Another example from my own research, but much more recently, is that of disordered networks in the cell cytoskeleton. So the picture on your right is a super resolution picture of a filamentous actin network. Actin is another protein, it's a bit like microtubules I mentioned before. And here you see that at the edge of the cell, the filaments are in all different directions and they're disordered. Now, these filaments in our muscles are all nicely ordered and interact with little proteins called molecular motors that cause contraction. However, in this cell here, the directions are all random, and yet you still get contraction. So this is an example of a system which is disordered in some sense, but it's working. There's emergent property coming out of it of contraction, and this is crucially important in our immune cells moving, for example. So disorder creates and destroys life. It's both positive and negative. Mutations are necessary for the evolution of life. This was touched upon earlier, but mutations can also lead to cancer. I think John Polkinghorne expressed this very nicely by saying the created order looks like a package deal. You can't have one without the other. So disorder here in the form of mutations is both very positive and very negative in different situations. And we cannot have the positive without the negative in the way that it works in nature that we see. So this brings me on to the more theological reflections. I'm going to first talk about creation and the concept of order out of disorder in creation. So in Genesis 1, as you well know, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters." Empty, formless, darkness, deep waters. These are all concepts that relate to disorder. And yet you know that that passage goes on with the famous words of God saying, "Let there be light." And day after day, God creates order out of that initial disordered state. Another example of this is in the creation story in Job. "Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, this far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waters halt. So to quote my own PhD supervisor, Tom McLeish, in his recent book, chaotic energy is not denied, but channeled. So that was on a comment. That was a comment in his book on this passage in Job. So we see here that disorder is actually as much part of creation as order is. So to quote Tom McLeish again, the theological narrative of chaos and order is far more complex and interesting than a simple triumph of one over the other. God is not only the shaping force of order, he also unleashes forces of thunderclouds, lightning, and wind. And we see that in Job and various other places in the Bible. Alistair McGrath put this very nicely. He's not a physicist, but he was talking about physicists and said, for physicists, chaos is the womb of order. I think that expresses very nicely these concepts that myself and many physicists I know share, this natural feeling that actually disorder and chaos is the womb of order. So I'm going to here talk a few words about open theism. I put a question mark here. I know that this is somewhat controversial, but this is something that resonates quite well with me. The question here is, unlike us, does God know in advance the outcome of indeterminate, stochastic, or chaotic events? Does God know the outcome in advance of quantum mechanical events? Does God know exactly when something is going to bind to something else in a stochastic event or not? So the term open theism was, I think, first used by Richard Rice in 1980, and it's described by Arthur Peacock as God is omniscient with only a probabilistic knowledge of the outcome of some events. God is omnipotent, but self-limited by God's nature as love. That's quite a technical way of putting it. John Polkinghorne describes it in a less technical way. If the future is truly open, even God does not yet know the unformed future. There is a general overall purpose being fulfilled in what's going on, but the details of what actually happens are left to the contingencies of nature. This is happening rather than that. The picture is of a world endowed with fruitfulness, guided by its creator, but allowed an ability to realize this fruitfulness in its own particular ways. Chance is a sign of freedom, not blind purposelessness. So that says a lot about free will, but it raises some questions about a classical theological interpretation of God as omniscient and omnipotent. So I would like to make a few comments about causation here, which follows nicely on from here. So physicists, the subject of physics is the master of reductionism in some ways, historically. Physicists break everything down into the constituent particles to understand it, particle physics being an extreme example of this. But in modern physics, again and again in different areas of physics, we see that actually the whole is more than the sum of the parts, that we see behaviours emerging when we have lots of particles together that we don't see when we study the individual particles that make them up. And philosophically, we have questions about causation, as in, are things caused by the constituent particles then causing an upward causation on larger length scales, or is causation top down in terms of things coming in from the top, like fields of energy, forces, etc., affecting the individual particles? Top down and bottom up causation. I'd like to suggest that both is happening in many of the systems that we study in nature. There's many questions here involving energy and information. And if you're thinking about top-down causation, what is the role of information here? I'd like to quote John Polkinghorne again here. He says, there is much cloudy, unpredictable processes throughout the whole physical world. It is a coherent possibility that God interacts with the history of his creation by means of information input into its open physical processes. Now, when I was preparing this talk, I thought it would have nothing to do with the topic of today's conference, miracles. But actually, as I was sitting there this morning, I realised there are lots of things that are relevant to the main topic of today's conference, and this is one of them. Is this a mechanism whereby God can interact in the world? I'm not going to answer now these very difficult questions. I just wish to pose it. Is God in control? I would say overall, yes. But there's plenty of randomness so that we can have free will. I'm one of those people who has a deep gut feeling that I have free will, that I have free choice over choices and actions that I have, and many people share that. I want to draw a comparison with the disorder on small length scales and order arising on larger length scales I've been talking about in science, with the idea that God's view, which is larger than ours, God might see order where we are stuck in the details and seeing only disorder. And I think this might be helpful in many situations in our lives when we don't understand what's going on and we think it's a big mess, but God might see a bigger picture. I think disorder is also a challenge to our sense of ordered fairness. And Jesus' parable in Matthew 20 is a good example of this, of the workers. I won't read the quote, but the workers are all fed up. Those workers who were hired at the beginning of the day are very fed up when they find that they get the same pay as those who were hired at the end of the day. But the employer says, I am not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Or are you envious because I am generous? I think this is an example of where God's idea of fairness can clash with ours. And we seek ordered, fair answers. Disorder is a challenge to our desire for ordered answers. Sometimes we find there's a gap between church teaching and our real experience as Christians. And I think disorder can be a challenge to our desire for ordered answers. We don't always get ordered answers. To quote Job again, the Lord says, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Would you discredit my justice?" Job replied, "Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know." Job cries out in his suffering, but he is not given nice, easy, ordered answers by the Lord. And in fact, the nice, easy, neat, ordered answers he's given by his comforters are criticized by the Lord. Finally, I'd like to throw out the concept that we could compare disorder to sin. This is negative disorder to sin. Sin as disorder ruining God's order. And that to bring order out of the disorder caused by sin, that cost Jesus' death. So maybe this concept of order and order has something to say about atonement as well. So to wrap this up, I'd like to suggest that order and disorder is a paradox. And as Westerners, we find paradoxes very difficult. But the Hebrew worldview was far more comfortable with paradox. And the Hebrew worldview often contrasts apparent opposites. We see this in many places in the Bible. And today, maybe we need to be looking to Eastern philosophers, Chinese philosophy, about the yin and the yang, seemingly opposite forces interconnected. And so maybe some of the difficulties we have with these sorts of concepts come from our Western worldview. So to conclude, I've talked about some examples of how ordered processes can emerge from microscopic disorder, and that these ordered patterns are sometimes beautiful, and that can lead us to wonder at the ingenious mechanisms that are behind these beautiful patterns and order that we see in the world. And for Christians, that leads us to wonder and worship. And that's where I'll finish. Thank you.
Well, Rhoda, thank you very much indeed. Much thought, provoking stuff there. Fascinating. I'd love us to have time for questions, but I'm afraid we really can't if we're going to keep to time. So thank you once again, worthy recipient, and we look forward to hearing lectures from you in the future.